then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, your vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 14th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
There are a few developments in the Edgar Steele case. Ed has a new attorney now, since his last one was disbarred as an embezzler, and his first one suspended for being a drunk. Hopefully, he'll have better luck with Mr. Hoyt. The family seems to think so at any rate. Ed has also released another article from Behind the Wire, which I posted on the Thought Crime blog on July the 12th, and which shows that at least he's holding up in prison, which is good news. Right now, we're just waiting for sentencing in August. Ed is looking at something like a possible 70 years in prison, for nothing but words, words which he in fact never said. Even the prosecution itself never claimed that Edgar Steele actually did anything physical. It was the federal informant, Larry Fairfax, who actually wired the bomb to Cindy Steele's car. Fairfax will be out of prison by Christmas, but Edgar Steele is looking at 70 years. Great country we have here, right? They might as well give him 700. At age 66, any sentence at all is realistically a death sentence. I'll have more to say on this once we hear how it's played out. I've been doing a lot of ranting and raving on my own for the past few episodes, and so I'm going to turn this one over to you, the listeners, as much as possible. I'm going to play some audio clips from you, and later on I'm going to get some of your emails. Now, some time ago I asked you guys to send me some audio files describing how you yourself came to white racial nationalism, and one of you complied last week. This is Jason from Oklahoma.
Greetings to my fellow white patriots across America and in our ancestral homelands in Europe and Northwest Asia. My name is Jason, and I want to introduce myself and tell you about how I came to racial awareness and discovered a real purpose worth living for. That purpose is, of course, that of securing our people's future on this planet and eventually out among the stars, and to give our kids the legacy that should be their birthright as children of the most capable, creative, and accomplished race ever to walk the earth. I'm a former Air Force officer with a master's degree in electrical engineering who led our men and women in the armed forces for 9 years before finally escaping that modern, conformist, politically correct straitjacket of the mind we call our military. I have been racially awake and aware in the natural and healthy sense that we all know and understand since 2005, after having read Jared Taylor's article Africa in Our Midst on black lawlessness and chaos in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. This started me on a path of systematically seeking out the truth about race and its impact on the world through my own researches in a more specific and structured way than simply observing the obvious inferiority of non-whites in general and blacks especially, and choking down my thoughts about what every child in school who comes into contact with them quickly learns and soon comes to think, that niggers as a group quite obviously suck, and thank God I'm not one. So after subscribing to American Renaissance, which then became my primary source for my racial education, and which I still check almost daily, I progressed to many others, such as the Occidental Quarterly, the Majority Rights Blog, the National Policy Institute, and the Council of Conservative Citizens. After coming to David Duke's website and also the Occidental Observer and the outstanding work of Dr. Kevin MacDonald, I discovered the Jew behind the curtain in all of this, that Jared Taylor and American Renaissance will never let you see. I finally gained a full understanding of the 2,000-year war Jews have been waging against white nations and our civilizations from the writings of Dr. William L. Pierce, Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, and Dr. Revelo P. Oliver, having been directed to these men through Alex Linder's Vanguard News Network. Alex's Radio Astina and Goyfire broadcasts in particular were the breath of fresh air I had been looking for. They also brought me to the 14 words of David Lane and the resistance of Robert Matthews and the other members of the Order to our planned civilizational and racial death at the hands of the world's Jewish elites. Because of this, I still hold Alex Linder's racial work with his excellent Radio Astina, if not being in itself, in very high regard for its quality and the active resistance it represents, although I do realize that Linder isn't on board with the Northwest migration concept. But still, as recently as a year ago, after 5 years of continual and sustained effort at re-educating myself, I thought making programs like Radio Astina was all that was left for white patriots, unashamedly broadcasting the truth and hoping against hope for some change in our people's understanding, that the right words, enough of them, said in the right way, might somehow make a difference and stop the coming apocalypse of non-white dominance and increasing abuse against us that becomes more evident each and every day. This vague hope in the power of speaking out was all I had to believe in until, through YouTube, I found the Northwest Front and the practical outlines of a new and better future for white humanity as contained in the Butler Plan. I have always believed in the old saying that the truth has a certain ring to it, and allowing that maxim to guide me has led me to the Northwest Front. The Butler Plan and Northwest migration makes sense to me as a military man. If you want to actually win and solve the problem, rather than just endlessly talk about the problem to make yourself feel better, you simply must have a stronghold of your own in the midst of enemy territory, one that can be protected and kept inviolate, where you can gather, renew yourself, concentrate your forces to withstand enemy attack, and plan for your continued survival and ultimate victory, however that is defined. There is no alternative. This concept is precisely why creating the racial state of Israel and keeping it has been so important to the Jews. Whites, however, are not allowed today to even conceive of this need or to speak it to one another. And indeed, increasingly, we no longer have such a place anywhere on this modern interconnected earth that can serve as our base and sanctuary. We need our own Israel, and this need will one day be fulfilled on this earth, as most necessities usually are. One thing we must understand is that it can happen sooner rather than later if enough of us take action sooner rather than later. So now, at the end of an intellectual journey that began 6 years ago, I know that I am mentally and emotionally finally home. And someday before too long, I will be coming home physically as well, as I begin to plan my migration to the future white homeland. As Harold has said, the Northwest Imperative and the coming Northwest American Republic are the real deal, and I am grateful to be one who has recognized it now that it is here. The Jews who now control in America and Europe, and their legions of white corporatist dupes would wish otherwise, of course. They'd much prefer that I had remained the unaware, half-unconscious, TV-watching and Xbox-playing consumer animal I used to be, sitting in my lazy boy night after night, trapped in place by feelings of powerlessness and the inertia of my own ass. But I am not that any longer. I'm an awakened Aryan man who has been renewed by a sense of our race's potential and destiny that I should have been given as a child. But no matter, I have now come to where I am intended to be, however long it took. And now I know this, that we do have the ability to overcome the slow mental and spiritual death of Jewish implanted white guilt for the crime of being too successful on this planet. A mental and spiritual death that is even now leading us into physical death as a people. As part of my fight, I will be moving to the new white homeland in the Northwest, so that my contributions to our survival will not be effectively wasted, because I am living in isolation from other self-aware defenders of my race. It is a life choice to be with my own kind, and stand in common defense of our people and a future which we will make for ourselves in the only way which life itself is worth living, deliberately, actively, and consciously.
A quick comment. I've noticed that a lot of people do come into proper white nationalism through Jared Taylor's American Renaissance, despite the fact that he's completely squishy on the Jewish question. He's got rabbis on his board of directors and rabbis speaking at his conferences, so forth and so on. Now, as a group, I can't, of course, recommend American Renaissance. Remember what A.K. Chesterton said all those years ago. If they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. But, having said that, Taylor's written material on the subject of race, every aspect of race, from the scientific and biological to the economic and moral aspects, is spot on, none better. And it's so good that I can recommend Taylor's stuff as an introduction to new white people you come across who are completely uneducated racially, but who are starting to become aware. A lot of people have never even read a racial book or pamphlet or webpage, anything like that, and Taylor's work is a good place to start them out. Go ahead and give them Taylor's books and newsletters and whatnot. And once they become accustomed to the idea of speaking honestly about race, then you can ratchet it up a notch. You can tell them about the Jews. Get them mainlining, so to speak. Now, you guys may recall that sometime back I was running some audio clips on here which had to do with our movement's past. Speeches by George Lincoln Rockwell, Huey Long, Sir Oswald Mosley, William Pierce, so forth and so on. I've been looking all over for a usable recording of the Reverend Gerald L.K. Smith, and that's another name that anyone who is really into the history of the white resistance movement in this country needs to know. Smith was a former aide and associate to Huey Long before Long was murdered in 1935, and until his death in 1976, Smith ran a number of religiously oriented publications and organizations from his home in the Ozark Mountains. His Cross and the Flag magazines were some of the first racial publications that I ever read, and I always admired its simple layout and its general handiness as a propaganda tool. It's kind of like what I'd like to see our own Northwest Observer become one day. During his heyday, Smith was also recognized as the most powerful and charismatic stump speaker on the whole racial right, and that's one reason I'd love to get some decent recordings of some of his speeches and sermons to play on here. Now, all I've been able to find on YouTube so far is this one brief clip of under a minute in length, but it does give you some idea of Smith's style and his oratorical presence. Now, this recording is from Cleveland in 1936, some kind of anti-Roosevelt rally. The YouTube clip doesn't even make that clear.
These great phenomenal assemblies, whether they be headed by Dr. Francis E. Townsend, Gerald Smith, or Father Charles E. Coughlin, represent the unmistakable edict that is being issued to the corrupt, thieving politicians of America that the baby-having, stump-grubbing, sod-busting, go-to-meeting, God-fearing American people are about to take over the United States government of America.
Now, if anybody can point me to any usable recordings or media interviews by Gerald L.K. Smith somewhere on the internet, I'll be grateful. Okay, now Axis Sally's up.
What is the New World Order? Alternative political people all across the spectrum tend to throw the term New World Order around quite a bit, generally as a designation for the government, or the Jews, or the trilaterals, or the multinational banks, or just quote-unquote them. The New World Order is all these things, but it is not just a collection of institutions and people, it is an idea, a genuine, if thoroughly evil, vision of mankind's future. The best way I've heard it put is that it's the idea of the great global consumer plantation, a social and economic order ruled by a tiny and immensely wealthy Anglo-Zionist elite who will command a worldwide population of homogeneous, coffee-colored industrial serfs bred from the forced admixture of all the present races of the earth. Another way to describe the New World Order would be the final development of capitalism. For several centuries, first Europe and then the rest of the world have been torn between two conflicting philosophies, both of them Jewish in origin. Capitalism arose from the collapse of the feudal system and the infiltration of Jewish bankers and moneylenders into the European economy during the Renaissance. The more recent Marxism is, of course, named after the rabbi's son Karl Marx, but its tenets are actually of older and of somewhat obscure origin. You've got your levelers and whatnot from the 17th century, and of course the Adam Weishaupt episode from the 18th. I've never completely bought the entire Illuminati story, but there were very definite Marxist elements in the French Revolution. This isn't the time or the place to go into a long digression on the history and ideology of these two competing forces, but basically both Marxism and capitalism share the same materialistic, essentially Judaic view of mankind and the human condition. Both consider man to be an economic animal and see human beings as interchangeable units of economic production and consumption. People are merely components of the great economic machine either of the marketplace or the quote-unquote dictatorship of the proletariat. They have only material needs, which must be met at a certain minimal level in order to keep them functioning in the economy. People have no spiritual needs or identity, no culture, no race, no religion, no aspirations, no independent thought. They exist solely to be installed like spare parts and worked until they are broken or worn out, when the system then pulls them out, throws them away, and installs a replacement part. It is essential to understand this opinion of people by both capitalism and Marxism, because it is this view of man as a soulless, raceless component in a human anthill which has led to the imposition of the thoroughly bogus idea of racial equality in both capitalist and socialist countries. Both systems are instinctively aware of the fact that their ideology is incorrect, that men are not soulless economic units whose sole purpose in life is to work and to consume and generate profits for the elite. But instead of accepting nature's human creation and changing their ideology, thus giving up their profits and elite status, both Marxism and capitalism seek to change mankind into the coffee-colored, mindless, cultureless mass of docile workers their philosophies envision. This is why both Marxism and capitalism are evil. By seeking to recreate mankind to fit their own ideas of what men and women should be, they are challenging God. Like two demented moral Frankensteins, Marxism and capitalism have both decided they can do a better job than the creator. It is now apparent that outright Marxism, as such, has lost the contest, but capitalism has by now absorbed a number of welfare state aspects of Marxism, and so what we have now is a kind of meld between the two, although there are some signs that capitalism is reverting to its older 19th century laissez-faire form and by the next century, if unchecked, may have eliminated all of the aspects of Marxism it assimilated during the time of competition. In any case, capitalism and liberal democracy are now moving full speed ahead to seize control of the entire planet and its resources, and to create the pliable brown workforce it requires to create the global plantation for the generation of obscene profits, the like of which the world has never seen before. This effort is, of course, spearheaded by the United States and world corporate power structure. We see evidence of this in the growing tendency towards military intervention around the world, actually a form of piecemeal conquest. The blue-helmeted troops come to bring peace, and somehow they never seem to leave. We see this in the virtual abandonment of any form of immigration control in North America and throughout Europe. White countries are being flooded with third-world mud, and already we can see published references in the controlled media to eliminating racism by eliminating race, i.e. mass compulsory interbreeding. We see this in the forced unification of Europe, in NAFTA and GATT, in the looting of Russia and the Eastern European countries by corporate buccaneers in, well, you get the picture, it's all around us. You'll find that when you study the news from this viewpoint, all of a sudden things start making sense. The role of the Jews in all of this should not be ignored, but neither should it be overstated. They are a significant part of the problem, but not the whole problem. The problem essentially lies in the inner spiritual weakness and confusion of white men throughout the world. Once the white man changes his thinking and recovers his ancient courage, our victory is certain. For the white man today, there is only one alternative. We must create our own nation with our own laws here in the Pacific Northwest, as a homeland for all our people worldwide, where our kind can live and raise a whole new generation of white children in security and moral health. Times are different now, and the New World Order is in fact far weaker and more disorganized, more corrupt, and more confused, and less able to suppress rebellion than it was in times past. For example, National Socialism survives even in Germany, despite the most vicious persecution. Like Marxism, unrestrained capitalism doesn't work, although it does function more effectively, but for a time only. Eventually, capitalism's contradictions catch up with it. The New World Order is already starting to fumble. If you will pardon me a final paraphrase from an old Marxist propaganda slogan, you may think we Northwest nationalists are beating our heads against a wall. So we are. But it's a rotten wall, and a few good kicks will send it crashing down into the dust.
Last week, I ran all of our music cuts together in a kind of themed presentation. And the upshot of your opinion that I got by way of feedback is that you preferred the old way. So for our first music break, here's another early David Allan Coe that one of our comrades sent in.
I like sugar and I like tea, but I don't like niggers, no siree. There's two known things that'll make me cute. That's a hog eating slop and a big black spook. You know it, cause I show it. Like a barnyard rooster, I crow it. And the end of a lazy pee. Would sure like to get a hold of a nigger hating me. Roses are red and violets are blue. And niggers are black, you know that's true. But they don't mind, cause what the heck? You gotta be black to get a welfare check. And I'm broke, no joke. I ain't got a nickel for a coat. And I ain't black, you see. So Uncle Sam won't help poor nigger hating me. Jigaboo, jigaboo, where are you? I was here in the woodpile watching you. Jigaboo, jigaboo, come out now. So I'm scared of the white man way down south, you know it. Cause I show it. Stick your black head out and I blow it. And the NAACP can't keep you away from a little old nigger hating me. On the wall, who is the blackest of them all?
A man named King, it ain't no doubt, and he's causing lots of trouble with his baboon mouth. The ruin
he's a doing is caused by the trouble he's a brewing, and the end of a NAACP can't win if a white man stick with nigger hating me. Hey, Mr. President, what do you say? When are we whites gonna have our day? The niggers had theirs such a long, long time. I'm a white and it's time that I have mine, you know it. Cause I show it, stick your black head out and I blow it. And the NAACP can't win if a white man stick with nigger hating me. Nigger hating me. Nigger hating me. Nigger hating me.
Actually, let me walk that back a bit. That sounds a little early to be David Allan Coe, although that's who the guy that sent it in claims it is. Maybe early Johnny Horton sounds a lot like him, but I think it sounds more like the individual using the name Johnny Reb. Now, on an upbeat note, I would like to congratulate Comrade Mike from Montana and his wife on the birth of their daughter last week. Now, for obvious reasons, I don't want to give any more details, since both of these folks have jobs to protect. But I just thought I'd mention this to let you folks out there know once again that slowly but surely it is, in fact, happening. Mike and his wife are both recent migrants from the East, and they came here to the homeland to make their lives and raise their children here. It's happening, people. Way too slow, but it's happening. I might also add that this weekend I received a welcome visit here in the Seattle area from some of our comrades in Europe. They apparently came all the way out here to see the elephant, so to speak. And yeah, we can take all the fat jokes as read. But the point is that the Northwest idea is spreading. Our stat counter tells us that we have listeners to Radio Free Northwest and visitors to our website from all over the world now. We've gotten hits on our site from Communist China, all kinds of weird places in Africa and Asia that I didn't even know they had internet there. Not to mention every country in the white world. Japan, South America, you name it, we got a hit from Greenland once. We got one from the Central African Republic once. Now we got another book review from Gretchen the Librarian, and this one has something to do with Druidism, I believe. I know I promised you I'd get some emails, but actually I think it's more important to prioritize actual audio files so that people can hear other voices than mine. You see, part of what I suppose you might call the disinformational narrative being put out on the internet and elsewhere about the Northwest Movement is that Harold is supposed to be all alone. I have no support in the movement. I'm just one guy sitting here playing with my computer. Well, I certainly don't have as much support as I should have, that's true. But neither am I just one guy sitting here all alone anymore. And I need to demonstrate this as often as possible as a kind of an aid to controlling our narratives, so to speak. Anyway, here's Gretchen.
Good evening, comrades. This week, I decided to read a book called The Druids, Celtic Priests of Nature, by Jean Markale. This is a fascinating book that takes a serious look at Druidism, both in Ireland and really throughout the Gaelic lands. It has a lot of very fascinating information. First of all, I'd like to get to some of the most important points. The author has so much to say in this book, but one of the points that is driven home is that the Druids were really monists. That is to say, they believed in a single overriding truth. At its heart, that's why the Celtic society, particularly in Ireland, where it persisted the longest, was so easily converted to Christianity, because not only did the Celts have this idea of the Trinity in that they recognized three seasons and had three classes, the sacerdotal class, warrior class, and the artisan class, but they also believed in a heavenly realm that the soul was born into after death. Now, there's been a lot of speculation that they may have believed in reincarnation. I can understand where this speculation comes from, because the Druids really like, for example, the Germanic peoples. The Druids believed in a hot cosmos, or an ever-fluctuating cosmos. And in this case, I could see where souls could possibly go in and out of an earthly realm, and thus is born the speculation that Celts or Druids specifically believed in reincarnation. But the author says that there's really no sound evidence for this. There's no clear or compelling evidence for this, aside from a few mystical tales, but really nothing more than that. The author actually feels that the Celtic culture, the Druid beliefs, were really very vigorous and very life-embracing, and therefore the author feels that the Celtic beliefs are really the opposite of a lot of Eastern-influenced New Age thought. Although the author does say that a lot of Westerners today are turning to New Age and Eastern philosophies because of a religious identity crisis, because Christianity really being from the Middle East and really being imported into Europe. So the author understands where that comes from. The author also talks about Neo-Druidism, which he sees as an honorable or understandable undertaking, but he also sees this undertaking as really impossible because of the three classes. The Druid was always the advisor to the kings. So if you don't have Celtic kings, then you really can't have a Druid. So there really is not the possibility of authentic modern-day Druidism. The author talks about some of the more of the details about Druidism. The author clarifies early on in the book that the Druids never built any temples. In fact, the Druids' sense of the other world was really more of a different dimension than a different place. And because of this, the Druids would worship in clearings or in a grove. There's no reason to associate the Druids with Stonehenge whatsoever, although I agree it's fun to imagine them using Stonehenge, but Stonehenge actually predates Celtic society, and there really is no particular evidence that the Druids used the structure. The Stonehenge, of course, is designed for the winter and summer solstices, particularly the summer solstice. But the Druidic festivals were four times a year, May 1st, which was Beltane, November 1st, which was Einheim, and then a February 1st festival and a August 1st festival, which is 40 days after the solstice, which is a harvest festival. So they really did not celebrate the solstices, and they had a lunar calendar. Also, as far as cutting mistletoe with a gold scythe, well, gold really couldn't cut anything very well, but it could have been gold-colored, and they didn't necessarily harvest mistletoe with the berries on, because there's really no evidence for that. It's really hard to know a lot about Druidism. They were interested in initiating only a few as Druid priests, so it was a very closed society, very oral. It felt that writing, they could do it, but they felt that writing could be dangerous. Felt the spoken word was superior to writing and far more of interest to them. So in that sense, they seemed to be really, I would say, egoless, in the sense that they don't really care about a posterity. They felt that truth is one, and that in their midst they have this succession of various sacerdotal classes that one would replace the other. So Christianity was a very sort of easy transition for them, although the author understands the religious identity crisis that many European people now have, and he understands why European people try to be neo-Druids or try to go towards Eastern religions. The author does feel that there is a need for a unique European religion, but doesn't feel that it's been found as of yet. I found this book fascinating, and I would like to read other books by this author. So I would recommend this book, and I would say take it low, because there's a lot of concepts and there's also a lot of names of deities that you may not have read about before. So thank you for listening, comrades.
Gretchen, you might want to pay a bit more attention to your editing on whatever audio program you're using on your computer there, because there were a couple of your words and sentences that got cut off in that clip, and it wasn't me, at least not this time. Also, I occasionally get emails from people asking why I waste airtime on such boring things as book reports. Well, it's because I'm trying to demonstrate some, pardon the term, diversity on the show. I want to show that we actually do have something to say besides me giving a long, boring speech and besides people yelling and screaming, nigger, nigger, nigger. I think that's part of the problem that some people have with discussing our own character on this show. I mean, it's not that they disagree or that they don't know that our own people have got major character problems. You only need to be involved in the movement for a very short period of time to realize that. It's because their idea of what white racial propaganda ought to be is just one long scream of abuse directed against blacks and Jews and Mexicans, and we need to present more subtlety and more depth than that. We need to show people that we've got a few brain cells to rub together, and that we can analyze issues, and that we can do more than an internet version of swilling beer and yelling white power and extending our arms vaguely in the air. Okay, yeah, I do remember that I just played a song called Nigger Hatin' Me, but I think you people mostly understand what I'm getting at here. Right, now, I promised you that we would use the rest of the show for your emails, so here goes. The first one is from Jesse in Alaska, whom I might add is 15 years old. Dear HAC, when are we going to start doing guerrilla three-people actions through the NVA like in the Brigade? Will we ever? I'm willing to join the NVA in about 3 years when I'm old enough to get down there. I get this kind of thing a lot from young white people and not-so-young white people, and in a way I'm very flattered. It's one of the greatest honors that a writer can receive from his readers, that they actually believe in the world he's created in his fiction so much that they want to live in it. For example, J.K.R. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter books, gets letters all the time from kids who want to go study magic at Hogwarts. Arthur Conan Doyle had the same problem. For years, probably a majority of the British reading public believed that Sherlock Holmes was real. And some bank that now has the address 221B Baker Street still gets letters from people all over the world addressed to Sherlock Holmes. Now they send these people a form letter telling them that Mr. Holmes has retired to Sussex to keep bees. Okay, let's start at the beginning with the basics. I have written 4 Northwest novels, and I'm working on number 5 right now. These novels are fiction. There is no Northwest Volunteer Army yet. And no, I'm not saying that to be cute or funny. I always put in the qualifier because I don't know what the future holds, and neither do the FBI and Secret Service and other secret police who listen to me, unless, of course, they're planning on arresting me using fabricated audio tapes wherein I supposedly try to hire a hitman to kill somebody. And they may be doing that for all I know. If so, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm always amazed when I get some guy, not a 15-year-old kid, but somebody you'd think would know better, writing or emailing in to me and making it pretty clear that he thinks either we're already in a revolutionary situation here, or else it's imminent, and he thinks he's going to come here and be issued a rifle or instructed in how to make a bomb and told to go kill somebody. Now, Jesse, to answer your question, we are already forming the equivalent of trouble trios in various places across the homeland. Now, as I said, I'm working on Northwest Novel No. 5, entitled Freedom's Sons. But within the next month or so, I'm going to complete the first draft of the second section of that book, which is entitled The Empire Strikes Out. Now, that will be kind of a good stopping point for a couple of months for me to take a break and get into some of the stuff that that national organizer I keep talking about should be doing. You know, the national organizer, the man who will become our Northwest George Lincoln Rockwell, the guy who has the fire in his belly and who will step forward to deal with the people part while liberating me to deal with the creative part. Now, we haven't found him yet. We almost did this week, but you missed him again. Now, this guy visited one of the racial V bulletin boards, but you were too scared to post the latest Radio Free Northwest link on there because you were petrified that some of the turkeys on the board might say bad things about you and yell at you. And maybe one of the egomaniac moderators would delete your post. Or worst yet, they might ban your ID from the board so you can't play there anymore. No, don't worry, I get that. I mean, I get it that it's far more important for you to be able to play on your favorite V-Bulletin board than it is to locate the man who's going to secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. Anyway, because no one posted to that V-Bulletin forum this week, we missed him again. He didn't see the NorthwestFront.org site, and so he still doesn't know that we exist. Well, better luck next week. Where was I? Oh yeah, the white book. And this does relate to Jesse's question. During my hiatus from the novel, I'll concentrate on redoing the party manual. Now, we're now on the third edition, which dates from January 2009, and we need to upgrade to the fourth edition. I'll go into this more when the time comes, but basically the fourth edition white book will take pride of place in your collections, which is of course why everyone will want one for their collections of right-wing and racist material. The fourth edition will be much more concentrated on local organizing here in the homeland than the third, and there will be much more detailed instructions for you to ignore on how to form and build local units, how to recruit people, how to use propaganda, so forth and so on. Basically, in this edition, I hold your hand and walk you through it step by step. I tell you exactly what you should be doing. Now, that means that you guys are going to have to really step up your game and work up a whole new set of excuses as to why you're not actually doing any of this. Because now you won't have the excuse anymore that it's all too vague and I haven't held your hand and walked you through it. Now, I expect a very high level of creativity in those excuses, the highest yet. But I'm confident that the innate ability that white people seem to possess in their very souls to find good, valid, perfectly rational reasons to do nothing will triumph. I know you won't disappoint me. Seriously, Jesse, you want to know when we're going to start up the NVA and start shooting? When it's time, son, when it's time. And that isn't up to me. I myself am really looking forward to that phase of the Northwest War of Independence. Maybe one of these days you guys will let me know when it's coming. Now, one last comment on that. One of the most successful local operations we have ever had in our movement came back in our old NSWPP days, and that was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area back in the 1990s. And it was led by Comrade Wagner Wotan, for those of you who may know him. Wagner doesn't get out much these days because he's elderly, and he and his wife both have very serious health problems. But in his day, he accomplished it all. Massive literature distribution, and this was pre-internet, remember, an active white power message that was ringing off the hook, serious media publicity. At one stage, I was doing all kinds of interviews down there for the Dallas and the Fort Worth media. New people coming in all the time, you name it. In short, for a brief time, Wagner achieved our movement's definition of success, as I mentioned a week or two ago. In his case, it wasn't the character issue that stopped him, it was his medical situation. And all he did was follow the book, the party manual of the time. All he did to get those results was to actually do what the manual said, instead of just adding it to his secret collection of racist material and hiding it away in a cardboard box in his basement so the little woman won't find it. Now, before the end of the year, you guys will have a party manual that explains to you in great detail, in words of one syllable, exactly what it is that you are expected to do. And if you follow the manual, you will get results, and you will become part of a world historical movement for white racial preservation. The problem is that it has one catch, like every other plan ever invented. You have to actually do all these things, not just read the book and then hide it away in a drawer to gather dust. Okay, second music break. Now, last week I played some historical music, including a song by the Johnson family, entitled Ye Jacobites by Name, and I got some emails demanding to know why I didn't play the Steel Eye Span version. God, you guys are really dating yourselves when you say that. Steel Eye Span was from the 60s, for Christ's sake, but yeah, they were really good. So I dug up another Jacobite song by Steel Eye Span for you. Now, this is a satirical little ditty about King George I, that king I mentioned last week, who had to be bribed by the Protestant establishment in Britain and came over from Germany to assume the throne without even speaking English. Now, he's the Geordie referred to in the song, and Bobbing John was a Scottish Jacobite leader and nobleman, the Earl of Mar. They called him Bobbing John because he changed sides so many times. Beyond that, good luck with the Scots dialect. And just remember, we are used to being able to satirize and criticize our leaders in this country. Look at John Stuart. Around the year 1715, if you were caught singing this song, you could be hanged, as in dead. You could be transported to the penal colony in Georgia or Barbados. You could lose everything you had just for singing this little song. So even though it is in a funny dialect, treat it with respect, guys, because some of our people suffered just for singing it. Okay, back to the emails. Now, this is from a guy named Iron Bear, and I don't know where he is exactly. Dear Harold, are you aware of the Chinese making plans to construct a self-contained city 50 miles south of Boise? Yes, I am, and we'll see how that plays out. Don't worry, even if they do, eventually it will be our city someday. The next email is from Chuck in Seattle. Dear HAC, you asked in the podcast for some suggestions. I suggest that the creation of a nonprofit 501 organization would be the way to go to give people something concrete to associate with. Every non-white organization has done this, and until whites quit being afraid of going public, they will lose. The primary thing about going public is all the funny costumes and racist rants have to disappear, and sensible dissemination of relevant information needs to take place. This format is very successful, as shown by the political cesspool being on the air for its 7th year. The other suggestion I would have is drop the podcast and get an hour show on the Liberty News Network, same place that houses the political cesspool and many others. Just my 2 cents worth. Well, first off, on getting the hour show on Liberty News Network, this is kind of a complex subject, but basically, Chuck, I don't trust anybody else's hand on the plug, so to speak. My experience has been that it is always a mistake for any movement, person, or group to put themselves more or less in the power of another movement group with some kind of vital facility or something that they can't really function without because, well, let's put it this way, it just causes problems. I make no bones about the fact, Chuck, that I intend to maintain total control over everything that goes out from my end of the Northwest Front. Now, if someone else wishes to speak for the Northwest Migration, that's fine. But I myself am not going to submit to any kind of censorship or any kind of threat of potential blackmail of, Harold, you stop talking about this, or Harold, you don't mention that, or else we'll pull the plug on you. This, I have noticed, always happens with some of these internet radio networks. At one stage, there was some discussion about getting on TalkShoe, and I looked over the situation and I vetoed it, and again, without getting into a long thing, eventually it turned out that that was the correct decision. Now, on the other subject, the 501. Well, maybe, Chuck. If there seems to be an actual need for such a body, we can do that, but we haven't done it so far for a number of reasons, and no, it's not just laziness on my part. Once you get into things like incorporation and 501s and trusts and legal entities of various kinds, you start leaving a paper trail, and you become entangled with the system. You have to file reports and minutes of annual meetings, and you place yourself at the mercy of government bodies who can legally demand that you hand things over to them, including records containing the names and addresses of others. Now, that, to me, has always been a no-no. It's just sort of a given. You don't hand other people's information over to the regime. This is one reason why I'm very leery about ever running for office again, because I would be required to file campaign reports that would give our enemies all kinds of information that does not concern them. Now, any paper or legal entanglement with a system goes very much against my grain and my personal experience. In this society, paper is what the system uses in 1,001 different ways to strangle genuine dissent and tie it up in knots. I don't want a situation to arise where we're tied down and tripping over our own shoelaces, so to speak, if you'll excuse my mixed metaphors. The main reason for such a legal entity would be, of course, to shield party property from malicious and abusive lawsuits. And if and when we actually own anything, specifically any property or a building or anything like that, then yes, we will need to fortify that property as much as possible against the Southern Poverty Law Center, to whom the slightest hint that a white nationalist owns property of any kind is like waving a red flag in front of a bull. And you have to bear in mind that the primary purpose of the Southern Poverty Law Center is to make money from Morris Dees and Mark Potok, and in order to do that, when they go after somebody, they have to get a visible trophy that they can flourish aloft in front of their mailing list of wealthy liberal and Jewish donors and say, see what we did to the wicked Nazi or Klansman or right-winger. We took his house or his farm or his business, and we made his wife die of cancer in the charity ward of the local hospital like they did to Kathy Metzger. And we burned his house down in front of the television cameras like they did to Pastor Butler, that kind of thing. One of the most tragic things I have ever heard of was poor Pastor Butler wandering around Coeur d'Alene the day after Morris Dees filed his lawsuit, looking for some kind of legal form book he could use to create a trust of some kind so he wouldn't lose his home. He didn't know that it was too late, and that even if the judge decides to allow it, an ex post facto trust or corporation can't shield assets against malicious litigation and civil judgments. Now, remember, Chuck, I've actually gone through one of these malicious and abusive lawsuits myself, and I've survived it. but in the process, I had to teach myself a lot of law, so I know whereof I speak here. The thing is that even a 501 or a trust or a corporation of some kind will not protect our property, if we ever have any, either from Morris or from some state or federal asset seizure laws if the regime decides they're going to make a financial example out of us or try to silence us or shut us down by seizing all our stuff, period, end of story. For one thing, federal asset seizure laws are pretty much irreversible. Now, I know that there are victims of asset seizure who've taken the government to court, although how the hell they got the money to pay for attorneys, I have no idea. Remember when Edgar Steele was arrested and the judge froze his and Cindy's assets so they wouldn't have any money to pay an attorney other than that drunk Roger Peavin? I have never heard of anybody actually getting their stuff back after the government seized it, although I may be wrong on that. A civil judge actually has more arbitrary power than a criminal court judge has. Ask anyone who's ever been through a bad divorce or a child custody case. All the judge has to do is bang his gavel and declare that the XYZ Corporation or the Bob Matthews Memorial Trust or whatever it is you set up is a targeted individual's alter ego, which is actually a legal term, and then the assets of that trust or corporation can be plundered in accordance with whatever civil judgment or asset confiscation order they've come up with. One thing I have learned, and which any lawyer will tell you, unless he can get more of your money by telling you otherwise, is that in this judicial system, the law is whatever the goddamn judge says it is. You can spend years setting up some kind of trust or nonprofit or corporation in Nevada or Delaware or the Cayman Islands, wherever, and it can all be blown away with one bang of the judge's gavel. And unless you have hundreds of thousands of dollars to appeal, and maybe get a higher court to reverse the idiot a few years down the line, you're screwed. My message on things like this for some years now has been one that a lot of people really, really do not want to hear. Because we're Americans. We are a completely materialistic people. We have been conditioned from birth to measure success or failure in terms of wealth and property and conspicuous consumption. And the idea of voluntarily renouncing the wealth of this world like we were medieval Franciscan spirituals is totally foreign to everything we've ever been brought up to understand or relate to. But nonetheless, if we are ever to truly financially bulletproof ourselves against this kind of enemy retaliation, we're going to have to do just that. We must voluntarily give up the material rewards that America grants for conformity. Because what America gives, it can also take away if we rock the boat. We must learn to live light, to move light, unencumbered by possessions, because it is our possessions that make us vulnerable. Now, I'll give you an example. As recently as 1998, when I was 45 years old, for reasons I won't get into here, I was forced to reduce my entire life to a single suitcase. Because of the way I've lived almost all of my adult life, I was able to do that. How many of you guys out there could do it? How many of you could reduce your entire lives to what you could carry in a single automobile on 48 hours' notice? A small automobile at that. I've had to do that on more than one occasion in the past 20 years. Okay, granted, now if we're going to get a proper legal party going here in the Northwest, we can't all be living like winos out of shopping carts and sleeping under bridges. I get that. We're going to need facilities and equipment. And don't get me wrong, I am not ruling out a 501 or something of that nature in the future if and when it looks like we can achieve a few years of legal and stable operation thereby. Right now, we don't need it. Right now, I'm still living light. Now, if the need arose, and I got raided, and all my stuff got confiscated, but for whatever reason they didn't take me at the same time, I could replace all of the truly essential equipment that we use right now for a few thousand dollars. And we have enough support so I could raise the money. Now, as I've mentioned before, the next step is to establish some kind of general headquarters for the NF, but that can be done without investing in heavy, non-portable stuff like real estate and copy machines and office furniture or whatever. At some point in the future, we may be in a position where we have property and plant and people who need to be properly organized and legally protected as much as possible. I hope that time comes, and comes soon. And when it comes, I will revisit the idea of some kind of incorporation or 501 or whatever, but right now we don't need it. Next email comes from Sue Enders in Raleigh. Dear Harold, since you can't get all these movement turkeys to stop talking and shouting about religion, I figure you might as well talk about it yourself. You said once you wished you had started a white man's religion when you were young instead of messing around with the movement. What would such a religion have been like, and what are your personal beliefs? Well, Sue, if you'll recall, I got into those topics in that one interview I did in December 2009 with the Occidental Quarterly, the one that the conservatives had pulled off the site and fired Greg Johnson over. And if anyone is interested, I'll send them a copy by email. Now, I do have certain religious and occult beliefs, true, but I avoid discussing them because I believe we are sent here to work on things in this world and not worry about the next. I personally think that if the white man needs a quick shot of religion or ethics, we can't do any better than the saying of the Stoic philosopher and Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius. If it is not right, do not do it. If it is not true, do not say it. If everybody would just obey that little dictum, we wouldn't have any of the problems we got today. But if you want to get a general overview of my personal spiritual philosophy of life, I got a song for you for our third music break that pretty much says it all. This is Makeham and Clancy.
I was a highwayman. Along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. Bastards hung me in the spring of 25, but I am still alive.
I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide. Sailed a schooner round the Horn of Mexico. I went aloft to furl the mainsail in a blow. And when the yards broke off, they say that I got killed. But I am living still.
I was a dam builder. Cross the river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. Place called Boulder on the wild Colorado. I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that great tomb that knows no sound. I am still around. I'll always be around and around and around.
I fly a starship across the universe divide, and when I reach the other side, I'll find a place to rest my spirit if I can. Perhaps I may become a highwayman again, or I may simply be a single drop of rain, but I will remain. I'll be back again and again and again and again.
In his prophetic novel, 1984, George Orwell predicted a tyrannical society based on the Marxist kind of Stalinism that he personally observed during his many years on the British left, especially during his military service in Spain. Now, this fictional society that Orwell created was based on the deliberate material privation and impoverishment of the masses of Oceania, his fictitious empire. And herein lies one of the two major areas wherein Orwell's gift of prophecy kind of failed him. If one can imagine a prosperous, wealthy, and luxurious life under Stalin, then you know the kind of world we've been living in for the past 50 years. Only now the luxury is running out, finally. White people are losing their jobs and their homes and their toys and their luxuries. And we are ruled by a nigger who clearly has the potential to become an American Idi Amin if the Democrats think they can get away with it. Now, the second aspect in which Orwell's gift of prophecy missed the mark was in portraying Oceania as a sexually repressed society where sex was criminalized, whereas today in the Western world, virtually every sexual behavior and perversion has been decriminalized and elevated into an alternative lifestyle backed by the full authority of the state. Virtually every perversion of thought and breach of decency, which Orwell predicted in 1984, is now part and parcel of our daily lives in one form or another. Although sometimes they're very artfully camouflaged. We live in a world of mind control, enforced political and racial orthodoxy. The concept of thought crime as expressed in modern American hate crime laws and European censorship of racial and revisionist views. There's the deliberate social engineering and restriction of thought through the enforced usage of politically correct language, like the ban on saying nigger and faggot and so forth. And there's this creation of an entire politically correct vocabulary, the purpose of which is to restrict thought into acceptable channels. There is swift punishment in today's world for any public deviation from racial and social orthodoxy. We have the creation of Big Brother and Big Sister-like figures in the form of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. There's the concept of rule by a corrupt inner elite. There's the public humiliation of dissidents through show trials for often fabricated crimes, such as the Edgar Steele case. There's the growing pervasiveness of spying and surveillance and electronic monitoring, including the telescreen or closed-circuit TV cameras everywhere. We have it all today. We simply accept it, as we accept so much more that is evil in our lives, because we're too timid and frightened and confused to resist. Every one of you listening to me now knows perfectly well that there's only one way that this tyranny will ever end, and we're well aware that that way has nothing to do with writing articles, or playing with computers, or running in puerile and pointless democratic elections. Every one of us listening to me knows perfectly well what has to be done, and yet we don't do it, because we simply don't feel strongly enough about our ostensible beliefs to risk death, pain, injury, and imprisonment in order to bring those beliefs into reality. When it finally gets down to the nitty-gritty, we sacrifice everything which is brave and noble in our racial character rather than experience personal danger or discomfort. Now, among themselves, in their own private conversations and publications, the Jews often refer to us as Esau, and they're right. Every day, each one of us, in one way or another, sells his birthright for a mess of rancid pottage. If there is to be any hope, we must have state power in a land of our own, and that can only be achieved through revolution. There is neither any need or any future for a quote-unquote white civil rights organization that politely begs and pleads with the tyrant to be so kind as to cease oppressing us. This kind of activity is a pointless and absurd waste of time. Our entire effort must be to prepare for the day when we will approach Zog with something in our hand other than our hat. It is not up to the establishment to give or grant us anything. It is up to us to take back our rights and our freedom if we are men enough to do so, and to die if we're not. I'm going to be very blunt about this. There are times throughout history when corruption and crisis become so acute, when the very fabric of civilization becomes so strained, that mankind must purge the poison from the body politic at any cost. Sometimes there is no other way for this to come about except for the gangrened limbs to be amputated. Sometimes humanity must literally sweat blood in order to survive. We are headed for such a culmination of our present crisis, and we must understand and accept that. There is a time of blood, death, and fire on the horizon, and this is not something that we have any choice about. We must understand it, accept it, and prepare for it. The Northwest Front has to spend the first few years of its existence building a network of small cells and affinity groups in every white community in the homeland. There's no harm in raising a little hell with the local Zog while we do it. But the main thrust of it all must be to prepare an infrastructure which will be ready and waiting when the time comes. We must identify members of our community, especially the young, who have the potential to become the leaders of our people in a true struggle for national and racial liberation. We must recruit them, teach them, and prepare them. And every local unit must have available to itself the kind of plant, equipment, and resources that will be necessary when the time comes to strike into the political mainstream. It must all be done right, and it must be done right from the beginning. I cannot overemphasize my profound personal conviction that we are running out of time, and we can no longer afford these constant false starts and dead ends. I don't know how much time I have left, but I'm going to devote that time to trying to bring the vision of a Northwest American Republic into reality. I could use some help, guys. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom. Follow in their footsteps on the rising of the